This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's like a volcano eruption. There is ash in the air. It makes my throat sore, and it feels dreadful.
The government says 600 separate blazes were burning nationwide Saturday, mainly across western Russia. More than 50 people have died and 2,000 homes have been destroyed in the fires. It comes during the country's most intense heat wave in 130 years of record keeping.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
I don't think that anyone disagrees with the fact that we actually are in the middle of a cold period that started about 9 years ago.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. In the summer of 2010, the world witnessed more signs of climate instability on a grand scale. The Arctic ice again retreated to near record low levels. In the United States, new heat records were set in many states. In fact, 17 different countries set all-time heat records this past summer, from Latin America through Africa and the Middle East to Russia itself. In Pakistan, floods beyond imagination created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. But the harbinger, the messenger from the future, took the Russian people into uncharted hell. Moscow, at the latitude of Alaska, boiled in the weather of Cairo, while grasping smoky air equivalent to 2 packs a day of cigarettes for every man, woman, and child. Russian leaders, who bragged global warming would be good for that northern country, got a taste of the coming century. Scientists are still debating about whether the abnormal heat, drought, and fires in Russia were caused by climate change. But we know for certain that this is the future. That is the coming century as temperatures climb, as the greenhouse atmosphere thickens with the exhaust of our fossil civilization. Let us see what we can learn together about how people and governments act under stress, about our vulnerabilities, about our chances of survival. To begin, we'll go straight to Moscow, talking with Vladimir Chuprov of Greenpeace Russia. We'll follow that with more analysis from Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. Dmitry has been scanning the Russian language press and blogs while talking with people inside and outside the country. Dmitry has some suggestions for survival. Are you interested in your food supplies? We'll squeeze in clips from a press conference with Lester Brown on the Russian grain export ban and the impact of climate on world food stocks. Can we even comprehend these grand events, these warning signs? I'm Alex Smith, and let's get started.
This is a serious abnormality. The Russian Weather Service has never measured such temperatures in Moscow in July. According to our calculations, it hasn't even reached its peak yet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The heat, drought, and fires in Russia during the summer of 2010 were truly shocking. To make sense of this, we're joined by Vladimir Chuprov. Vladimir, were you in Moscow during the heat wave, and can you describe your personal experience of these events?
This is Vladimir Chuprov. Yes, all this summer I spent in Moscow. And 2 weeks was most difficult, as it was a smog, round-the-clock smog in Moscow. Just to explain you, it was smelling with fire, so with temperature plus 40 degrees Celsius, which is absolutely untypical for Moscow, which is 20 degrees above the typical temperature this time. The visibility in the street, this distance of visibility was about 200 meters. People walking in the street with masks, not all of them, but a lot. And in a few hours of walking the street with masks, the mask is becoming brown. The air was full of carbon monoxide, which caused a lot of deaths, and the deaths rate in Moscow decreased twice. So it was quite horrible. So people waiting all the time. So it was impossible to open windows around the clock, especially in the night, as then the smoke get to the flat, to inside. So it was very extreme, especially for children and the people having disease, blood and lung disease. So all the people had shock, as it was quite untypical, and people were not ready for such extreme conditions, weather conditions. And psychologically, it was very frustrating, as people understood they can do nothing in this situation, because the power, the Ministry of Emergency Situation, who was in charge for firefight in this pit box near Moscow, they could do nothing. And it was a situation when the human being could not control the nature processes, which was very unusual and typical, and it showed that sometimes that the humankind, it coming to end, so it cannot control anything in this planet. So psychologically, it shaked Russian public, Russian society. As a result, according to the last poll opinion results, showed that the number of people believing to climate change and recognizing the climate change as a serious problem created by humankind increased from 20% to 28%. For Russia, it's a real jump up in understanding this problem. You should know that a Russian public as well as political elites is quite skeptical towards the climate change issue, things like carbon emissions, climate change effects, etc., etc. So for Moscovites, for majority of Russian people, it was real shock, and people, public opinion was shaken.
I'm wondering whether the Russian press is part of the factor in not preparing people for the possibilities of what can really happen under climate change.
It was very, very interesting experience. Yes, the people were not really prepared for such a climate change, as in the previous time, the Russian authorities, the highest politicians, they said they are in favor for climate change, as it's very beneficial for Russia, as it will open the Arctic shore for oil drilling, it will create better conditions for agriculture, etc. But this summer showed that it's wrong. It's wrong, and it's brought real results and showed real impacts, negative consequences of climate change for the community, for the people.
And I'm wondering, what about the personal experiences? Well, the effects of this outside Moscow, we had a lot of publicity here in the West about the smog and people wearing masks, as you said, but it seemed we had much less coverage about the fact that villages burned down and people had to be evacuated and what was happening out in the hinterland, so to speak.
Yeah, well, we can say that Russia consists of two parts, the Moscow and the rest of Russia. It's quite bad, as all the policy of Russia depends on the opinion of Moscovites, people living in Moscow. But yes, the people outside of Moscow were damaged and suffered by these heat waves and droughts, as officially 50 people killed in these fires. About 100 villages were evacuated. Thousands and thousands of people lost their homes, and now they're living in the hostels, in the hotels. So this is real tragedy for 1,000 families living outside, who lived near forests, and now they're damaged by these fires. A lot of human stories we learn in media this time. Sometimes these stories are quite horrible. Not all these stories and information we know we receive through the official federal channels, TV channels, which are monopolized by the Kremlin. A lot of stories when firefighters didn't protect people, but they protect houses and buildings of oligarchs. A lot of stories when people asked firefighters to come and to help to them, but they didn't have good enough equipment to help people. You should know that in Russia, 2 years ago, the firefight system was abolished, and all these functions were handed to provincial level, where they do not have any resources to handle this system. And the firefight system mostly fitted to work with the fires in the cities, in infrastructural sites and objects. So in this case, we saw a lot of stories and information for analysis. What the system, how it cannot protect people, how people had to protect themselves. So these fires this summer showed that the potential for volunteers movement in Russia is quite high, and people reacted immediately to call to people who ask this help. But another side of this medal, the government, the state, could not organize this activity. So people self-organized, they collected all the stuff, all the money, equipment to fight fire, etc., organized this fight fire brigades, but the state even didn't provide them with information how to operate, where to go, or even sometime they disturbed to them. So it was quite a lot of human stories around this fire this summer.
And I think that there will be comparisons to the U.S. Government's failure to respond to the Katrina situation after that terrible hurricane hit New Orleans. Well, another thing that I think is different here about this situation is in Europe, when they had the terrible heat wave in 2003, it came after they had managed to harvest their wheat and their grains, whereas in Russia it was right at harvest time, and there was a huge impact, as we know, on the grain situation in Russia. Can you talk just a little about that?
Yeah, the two sectors, economical sectors, mostly damaged due to these heat waves are agricultural and forest sectors. In agricultural, the official economical loss is about $1 billion equivalent, U.S. dollars equivalent. In forest, it's much higher, it's few billion dollars, U.S. dollars, direct economical loss equivalent. But according to some independent economists, the loss is dozen times higher, which could reach 10, 15 billion U.S. dollars for the whole Russian economy, mostly for forestry and agriculture. In agriculture, Russia this summer lost 11 million hectares of the fields, where Russia lost about 20% of its crops, and it brought to the situation where when Prime Minister Putin decided to shut down the crop export, Russian export, to international markets. We checked international markets as well. In forestry, Russia lost about 5 million hectares of forests. Not all of them were burned down, but as minimum 20-30% did. So it's a real impact for forestry sector as well. As well as two farmers who lost this harvest, and now they're seeking the support from the state. The good news is that the state is going and promised to provide financial support to the farmers suffered by these heat waves. And another problem we discovered for agriculture, for example, is insurance system. We understood, and it's very obvious, the existing insurance system do not have enough potential to cover such extreme climate weather conditions, such consequences for agriculture, for example, which means that the humankind system to prevent or to adapt financially adapt to climate change is not enough answer for such extreme change in climate conditions.
And I'm sure that will be the situation again here in North America. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Vladimir Chuprov, a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace in Moscow. Vladimir, in the past, you have spoken out against shipments of nuclear materials to Russia. The recent fires revealed more dangers to this whole nuclear project, from the so-called secret cities and maybe even radioactivity from the Chernobyl accident. Please tell us about the nuclear risks posed by these forest fires.
These fires, this hot summer of 2010, discovered another disadvantage of Russian economy, of Russian nuclear industry, Russian nuclear sector. These fires brought to the risk set of risks of Russian nuclear power plants as well as a nuclear facility presented by a dozen so-called closed military cities where they develop nuclear technologies, both civilian and military ones. These risks are associated with failure, the accidents connected with the electric system. This summer, as minimum one reactor shutdown was recognized as a result of overheating of one of the transformers at one nuclear power plant in Russia. Besides that, about dozen disconnecting of cable, electric cable connecting nuclear power plants with the grid, were disconnected, which created some troubles for reactor operating. As well as a heat wave created problem for cooling system, as you understand, you know that the typical Russian reactors presented by boiling reactors and pressure water reactors, they need cooling water, which should have special temperature around 30 degrees above zero. This summer, sometime this cooling water had about 36 degrees, which is very sensitive for any reactor system in Russia. As a result, in one of the nuclear power plants, they had about four shutting downs caused by overheating transformers and fires in transformer system. Russian nuclear authorities did not recognize these shutdowns with overheating, but we understand these shutdowns could also be associated and connected with this overheating and the heat waves. As well as these stories, well-known stories around the world with the fires near nuclear cities where they also have facility operating with the plutonium, especially with the Sarov Center, which is in the middle of the Volga River, where the fires come up to this nuclear facility a few thousand meters, which is quite close as the forest fire speed sometimes could reach a dozen kilometers an hour. The government even decided to evacuate all this facility with nuclear materials outside of these nuclear cities, nuclear sites. So this summer we had as minimum two nuclear cities, nuclear centers, where they had to adopt special preventing measures to decrease risks of fire, of burning down this nuclear facility having all these nuclear materials. So this is very obvious, showed that the nuclear facility, nuclear infrastructure is not adapted for coming climate change and the negative consequences bringing with coming with this climate change like heat waves, where this nuclear facility, which have having very sensitive technology, could fail due to these high temperatures. It's very obvious.
Vladimir, there's a lot of discussion in the scientific community about whether this record heat and drought was caused by global warming. What is your opinion about this?
Greenpeace position is very clear. All this global warming, all this new weather, negative consequences, new weather conditions, all this connected and caused by humankind activity with the carbon emission discharge from oil, coal, and gas industry. But in Russia, having quite skeptical attitude to this issue, only about 30% of population recognize and believe that this is the result of humankind activity. As well as political elites, as well as scientific circles, they do not, majority of them, unfortunately, still do not trust that this is the humankind activity result. You know that Prime Minister Putin is well known with his very negative position to Kyoto Protocol, to all this scientific base, saying that this is a result of humankind activity. And till now, in Russian media, it's very obviously we see that the position of the Prime Minister of majority of scientists, they're still quite skeptical. Even now, after this obvious results of climate change, they still did not change their position. Yes, there was a statement from the Russian president, Mr. Medvedev, who associated and said that he said very clearly, this is a climate change and this is a humankind activity. But this is the single voice of one person, which is synced in the voices of scientists who are saying that this hot summer is a result of climate weapon of United States America having special antennas and stations in Alaska and creating this weather in Central European part of Russia. Or this is a solar activity linked with solar cycles, or this is the just moving the center of magnet field of the Earth. I personally analyzed the public, the media, and from 10 interviews of scientists explaining such a conditions, weather condition in Russia, only one scientist said that this is the result of carbon emission discharge into the atmosphere, which is very clearly shown that Russia still is a castle of skeptical attitude, the state which will not believe to climate change till the end of the day. That's the bad news. But the good news, this summer, we saw some trends like a statement from President Medvedev, like a change of public opinion, which jumped from 20 to 28% people believing that this is humankind activity result. Prime Minister Putin asking this question, now he tried to understand for himself. Maybe he was wrong saying that it's just natural cycle. Maybe it's not. So, yeah, we have quite interesting tendency, and let's see next year how this public and elite opinion will be changed.
Well, thank you so much, Vladimir. And I want to say, reporting from Moscow, our guest has been Vladimir Chuprov. He's the head of the energy unit at Greenpeace Russia. Download this free interview at ecoshock.org and find out more from Greenpeace at greenpeace.org/Russia. Thank you, Vladimir.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Canada.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Was it global warming? Scientists seem to fall into three camps. A small group says the Russian heat wave was natural or even caused by an American climate weapon based in Alaska. Others say this was certainly made worse by human-made greenhouse gases. And the remainder wonder if it's too soon to tell without further study. But certainly, this is what we can expect in the future. We know that, given what we know from the models in the past.
Climate has always been changing, but this has nothing to do with man. In fact, we predicted that there would be extreme heat in East Europe and Russia this summer. And it's caused by a certain circulation pattern. CO2 does not cause circulation patterns. What causes those is a combination of solar activity and the state of the phases of the moon.
But hang on, Piers, excuse me, just a minute. You say this isn't caused by man. How come they're reporting this heat wave is recognised as the worst in 1,000 years of recorded history in Russia?
Well, of course,
man has got something to do with this, hasn't he?
No, nothing to do with it. The only connection is man is here at the same time as the sun and the moon are doing things.
Those calling the event natural are not all cranks, like Piers Corbyn, who you just heard talking with Russia TV. Corbyn is a meteorologist, astrophysicist, and professional weather predictor in England. In Wikipedia, he has been proven very wrong in his predictions. Martin Horling is a research meteorologist who specializes in climate for the Earth System Research Lab in Colorado. That's run for the American government's NOAA. Horling reviewed historical data on heat waves in Russia. He concluded that global warming did not have to cause this event. Rather, it was, he says, a black swan, an unusual stalling of airstreams that normally move weather systems as the Earth spins. Russia has experienced very hot weather before, but nothing like this, and never for so long. Still, Horling argues all the necessary causes can be found in the normal operations of weather without climate change. Not that he disbelieves climate change, far from it. The man warns this is exactly what many places on the Earth can expect, perhaps 70 years from now, due to the accumulation of greenhouse gases. Find a link to the NOAA draft report dated August 13th in my Radio EcoShock blog entry for September 2nd, 2010. For those with a subscription, Michael Marshall makes a similar argument in New Scientist magazine, usually a reliable source. It's titled, Frozen Jet Stream Links Pakistan Floods, Russian Fires. Personally, from my 21 years following climate change in both the press and scientific reports, I've heard too many projections of climate events expected 50 years from now that whirl up violently today. The same long-term predictions were made about the Arctic sea ice. I say climate change is with us now. Let's look again at Russia through experienced eyes. This is Radio EcoShock with the returning guest, Dmitry Orlov. He's the Russian expat who analyzed collapse in the Soviet Union. As a lesson for America in its last days of empire, Dmitry, I understand you finished a new manuscript. Can you give us some hints about that?
Well, I'm in the process of finishing it. It is basically an update to the first edition of Reinventing Collapse. Not that big an update, because most of what I said turns out to still be more or less up to date. Some of my predictions have started coming true. And also, now that peak oil is behind us, I can expand on what I said about energy in the first edition, because there are some repercussions that peak oil is starting to have that are going to become more and more obvious.
Let's talk more about that book as the publication approaches. Meanwhile, as you know, I've called to get some more insight into the experience about that massive heat wave and the fires in Russia in the summer of 2010. Would you care to give us some first impressions?
Well, I wasn't there, so what I know about it is what I was able to learn from reading Russian language press and blogs. Russians are, they use LiveJournal a great deal. That's their main blogging site. And there were a lot of interesting articles on LiveJournal from first-hand witnesses to the events. So that, for instance, whereas the government was saying that very few people really died and that the situation was more or less under control, what you learned from the blogs was that morgues were filled to capacity rather quickly, that operating theaters and hospitals that didn't have air conditioning had surgeons faint during surgery, that even appendectomies were postponed, that most people who were delivered to hospitals for resuscitation, in fact, died. So there was a bit of a jump in mortality. A lot of elderly people and people with respiratory problems and circulatory problems succumbed to this heat wave. But if you just look at the photos and the reports that came out of Moscow, the visibility was down to something like a third of a mile for a few days straight. This was really an environmental disaster.
Right, and Moscow is located at 56 degrees north. That's a similar latitude to the Alaskan Panhandle or Glasgow in Scotland. And so a warm, sunny day should be about 75 degrees there, not over 100 degrees or 38 Celsius as it was day after day. I'm wondering, there must be some psychological shock that this could happen, that the people there would feel. What do you think?
Well, I think that it takes a lot to shock Russians, more than most people. I think that there is a little bit of an understanding now that maybe the strategy of developing the Moscow region is not such a good strategy. Russia has become very, very centralized. It came under Yeltsin, it came to the point of dissolution. Various regions started going their own way. And then Yeltsin pulled it all back together, basically by concentrating authority and money and everything within Moscow region. And the result of that was very visible in the heat maps that came out during this heat wave, where there was a big red angry spot on top of the Moscow region. And you can understand that this is actually the result of all this economic development, because forests were replaced with developments, with roads, a lot of energy production, a lot of cars, all concentrated in relatively small geographic area, resulted in a place that during the summer is just not survivable anymore. Now, you're right that it's very far north, but it's also very far inland. There isn't the moderating influence of an ocean anywhere nearby. So the further you get into the center of Eurasia, which is a huge continent, the more of a continental climate you have, with very, very cold winters and very, very hot summers, brief but hot. And if this is the pattern, then this really means that Moscow region is not going to be survivable for much longer.
Well, and they also seem to have mismanaged the peat areas around Moscow, and that made the fires and the smoke even worse.
Well, I don't know what could be managed about peat bogs. They just exist. It's just that when it's very dry and very hot, they start smoldering. And this is something that has happened throughout the north of Russia, not just in the Moscow region, but also in the Leningrad region near around St. Petersburg. There were peat bog fires this summer and smoke.
Do you think it's fair to say that the authorities were poorly prepared for these events?
Well, there was actually, you know, the forestry director was fired by Putin as the result of all of this. And a lot of it really had to do with this equivocation in terms of who should be managing it. Because on the one hand, it must be conceded that things work a little bit better if everything is orchestrated from Moscow. On the other hand, they do try to put people, local people, in positions of authority. So there was a very confused plan where local authorities had to bid out firefighting to various private companies. Now, you can imagine that in an emergency situation, a bidding process is not exactly what you want to follow. So that was part of the problem, that, you know, the whole effort, it wasn't clear who was supposed to actually be organizing it, and the result was a bit of chaos.
Right. Well, you know, scientists around the world seem, they're still discussing about whether this Russian disaster was caused by global warming as such. The Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, said clearly that it was, and that's surprising considering the formerly cavalier attitude of the Russian government towards climate change. Putin said warming could be good for his country. Do you see a possible change in Russia's stance?
Yes, I can, because up till now, global warming was really something that Westerners talked about. And the funny thing is, you know, Westerners do talk about climate change and the need to combat climate change, but that doesn't stop them from buying Russian gas and oil and burning it, does it? So from the Russian point of view, it's just a bunch of Westerners talking out both sides of their mouth like they usually do. It doesn't really mean anything new or different or interesting. Now, what's different about the situation now is that the message has been brought to home rather forcefully. And Russians do tend to have a relationship with their land that is fairly intimate. And when they see such incredible damage occurring around them, they do tend to reflect on it. In terms of reaching consensus within the scientific community, you know, I think if we have to wait for scientific consensus before we actually decide to act or to take steps, we'll basically all die. And so I think that there's a little bit of an intuitive appreciation required in order to understand that this is something that, you know, it's happening. It's actually happening.
I couldn't agree more. You know, you bring up the scientists. It seems incredible to me that there are still Russian scientists, and not just fringe ones, who deny climate change vehemently. The most startling news stories quote scientists saying Americans are to blame for the heat wave. They think that the HAARP project in Alaska was used as a climate weapon. How could this Cold War thinking keep going in Russia against all experience and evidence?
Well, there's absolutely no accounting for what people will do or say for a bit of notoriety, and it doesn't really mean anything at all. I would say that, you know, people who pay attention to people who say things like that, you know, they bring it upon themselves. They could do just as well to completely ignore them.
I'd like to explore the Russian situation as a prelude for what we can expect in the coming decades in many parts of the world as the planet heats up. And you've looked at as sort of the survival techniques that were developed as the Soviet Union fell apart. So I'm wondering, in that context, what could we learn from what happened in Russia last summer?
Well, realization that we all need to have is that as the climate is getting more and more erratic, the only thing that we can really do to protect ourselves is to live within a microclimate that is survivable. So that if you live in a very built-up place that is denuded of foliage, then you're likely to die in a heat wave. But if you live in a very leafy and heavily forested place and keep it that way, have a bit of wetland around you, have a body of water next to you, things like that, basically live closer to nature, then you will stand a chance.
Well, maybe that's why I'm in Vancouver. Now, Dmitry Orlov, in your 2008 book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, you stress the importance of the kitchen garden to the survival of the average Russian. After what we saw this summer, I'm wondering if our community gardens and home gardens will also fail as more extreme heat and drought events come to visit. Is anyone really safe from a climate going to extremes like that?
Nobody is really absolutely 100% safe, and that is actually a rather ridiculous thing to strive for. We all take our chances. But a system where all sorts of different food from different types of seed are grown by many different kind of people in many different environments, I would say is much better adapted for a disrupted climate than industrial monoculture, which does row crop growing, commercial crops, which can all fail at the same time. And you can see those types of failures. One-third of the harvest, wheat harvest in Russia has failed. That will have repercussions on, you know, the couscous and the pasta eating countries around the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And a few years ago, I was in Vermont, and the entire corn harvest failed because it got rained out, because they all plant more or less the same variety at the same time. And so big agricultural systems like that that practice monoculture, industrial agriculture, are much more likely to suddenly fail in a catastrophic way than a system where many people are doing lots of different things. And if one thing doesn't pan out, then maybe another one will. And if the kitchen gardens don't have much of a yield, then there might be some wild foods. There's a way of planting edible species in a forested environment so that you have nuts and various other things and berries that you can fall back on. And Russians do quite a lot of that. There's a lot of berry and mushroom and nut picking that goes on.
Also, in your writing, you suggested that one of the things we'll need to do if civilization is indeed shrinking or collapsing, perhaps due to oil running out and other reasons, was that we'll have to secure the nuclear materials and try and decommission as much as we can of the nuclear projects. And now we see that in Russia, one of the more sensational impacts were the fires burning around nuclear bases and even forests soaked with radiation from Chernobyl. What can you say about that?
Well, I think that basically the ground has been laid for various types of catastrophes, big and small, in the nuclear nations especially. I think that, you know, some of the nuclear reservations in the United States are just as bad and in the long run just as unmaintainable as various sites in Russia. The radiation levels I believe they rose somewhat, but I haven't really seen any conclusive numbers on that as a result of the forest fires. But this is not limited to Russia to any extent. During the heat wave a few years ago in France, the nuclear power plants that produce a lot of the electricity in France that are all built along the Loire, a lot of them had trouble getting enough cooling water from the river because the water level in the river fell so much. So this is not by any means limited to a specific country. It's just that the nuclear industry is very dangerous and requires an intact industrial infrastructure in order to keep it under control. So since the lifetime, the half-life of these radioactive materials is guaranteed to be longer than the life of civilization or even the lifetime of the human species in all likelihood, there will be a lot of radioactive pollution on planet Earth moving forward. That's virtually guaranteed.
Well, and also learning from events in Russia, I noticed a lot of public anger and calls for punishment of officials. The government announced some criminal charges. And meanwhile, Prime Minister Putin was shown everywhere, even helping put out a fire from a water bomber. I'm wondering, extreme climate events could fuel demands for more authoritarian government, or they could hasten the breakdown of government. What are your thoughts?
It really depends on the local political culture. In Russia, a lot of the people are very suspicious of their government, very mistrustful of their government, but they're even more afraid of weakness. So if you look at who in Russia has the most authority, it's definitely Putin. Medvedev is pretty far down the list. He's liked, I think, to some extent, but he's not particularly powerful yet. And after Putin, I would say that the mafia has a lot of influence in Russia. And after the mafia, according to the various reports I've seen on this, it's the various ministries, the various officials that run the government. So it is really you know, it's the fallout from the weakness that Russia went through after the collapse of the Soviet Union and under Yeltsin that Russians are encouraged by having a leader who is actually not afraid to lead. For Western tastes, it definitely smacks of authoritarianism and doesn't resemble anything that they recognize as a democracy.
Well, I could see some impacts, though, on the United States as well. We saw how the Bush government failed during Katrina, which was definitely climate-related. And if we had a really extreme event in the United States, there could be demands for more authoritarian figures. I'm sort of worried about the Glenn Becks and the Sarah Palins of this world getting some kind of power as people just, well, they freak out because it's hot, and it doesn't stop.
Yes, I'm not particularly afraid of the Sarah Palins and the Glenn Becks because they're just far too incompetent. You look at these people and yes, there's some kind of AstroTurf movement that was paid for by some well-heeled individuals, and some misguided people are following them around, but it's very much staged. I mean, there's really no substance to it at all. It's portrayed as some kind of a grassroots movement, but really it's one of those, you know, AstroTurf lobbying campaigns that's just paid for by someone.
I found this Russian situation, the heat and the fires, were kind of shocking to me. It's another milestone event like the loss of the Arctic sea ice. I'm still not sure what it means, and I don't think I'm alone in that. What have you heard from others inside and outside Russia?
Well, for the longest time, Russians didn't really pay a lot of attention to all this talk about climate. They just weren't particularly interested in it. For the first time, Russia was prosperous, still is. For the first time, Russians can travel widely, can drive cars, can buy their own houses if they want. Russia, according to what the Russians see, is becoming a normal country. And this is something that they like a lot. And there's a lot of ostentation that has lately become fashionable in Russia. So Russians like to buy SUVs and drive them around. The roads in Russia are not very good, especially if you get out of the city centers. And so having a four-wheel drive all-terrain vehicle is actually seen as a really good thing. They like basically going through this kind of dream phase like the United States went through in the 50s, where everything is big and everything is new. They're putting up big box stores. They're embracing consumerism. They have internet everywhere, even in little villages. And, you know, this is something that they really want, and this is important to them. Now, all of this Western talk about climate change, so far they've been able to ignore it pretty well, but, you know, this event this summer maybe is changing it, and the fact that Medvedev is tapping into these feelings and actually saying that, you know, this is important and we have to find a new way to work, which is what he said, that's more or less a direct quote, basically means that, you know, the government is ready to get involved in figuring out what has to be done about it. One of the easiest things for Russia to do would be to cut oil and gas exports. So they wouldn't be depriving the Russian people of energy, but they would be depriving these Westerners who have been clamoring about climate change for some time. So this would give them a chance to do something about it by burning less oil and natural gas. I don't know that that's what he will do, but it seems like a logical step.
Well, as we close out, is there something you would like to add, another dimension to this story?
We'll just have to watch and see what happens. But every summer, every year, there's a lot of new developments. It's not just Russia. It's Pakistan underwater, for instance. Every year, we'll have more and more environmental disasters. It's not just a gradual rise in temperature. It's a gradual rise in the number of extreme weather events throughout the planet. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yes, we saw Australia burn last year, and here in British Columbia, we had fires so great that the smoke went halfway across the continent. So it's an ongoing story, as you say. Our guest has been Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example, and American Prospects. Look for the revised edition coming out soon. And did you want to say anything more about that new edition that you're working on?
It'll be out next spring. It'll contain quite a bit of updated material.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Follow Dmitry Orlov at his blog, cluborlov.blogspot.com, or check out his Wikipedia entry. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. I recommend you track down his previous interviews on Radio EcoShock and read up on Dmitry's work, because you will learn more about surviving our future challenges. Thank you so much, Dmitry.
Thank you.
I put selected links to interviews and papers by Dmitry Orlov in the Radio EcoShock blog for this program. Whether or not the Russian firestorm was directly caused by climate change, it is a hard lesson on what we can expect from the future. Here are just a few of the issues stirred up by the heat, the smoke, and the drought, and the fires. Learn what you will from these 15 warnings.
Number 1.
Fatalities from heat and smog caused the death rate to double in Moscow. Large cities can be attacked by climate change to become deadly traps.
2.
An estimated 2,000 Russians drowned trying to escape the heat. Some died in drinking fountains. Some drank too much alcohol trying to cope with the heat and stress.
3.
The fires revealed the extreme and nearly uncontrollable dangers posed by climate change to nuclear facilities, both power reactors and military bases. Think upon that.
Number 4.
Many people tried to leave the big city, Moscow, but were prevented by smoke-closed roads and airports. Subways became dangerous. Traffic accidents and fatalities went way up. Essential goods, including food and medical supplies, couldn't get through. Transportation systems break down.
5.
The number of homeless people grew as villages were burned out.
6.
Peat fires went up to 12 feet underground and are expected to burn until winter.
7.
Crops die. 1/5 of the Russian grains were lost, exports banned, and international wheat prices rose. In the future, grain importers like the North African nations may starve. Let's take a few minutes from our countdown to listen to this press conference with Lester Brown. He's the founder of World Watch and founder of Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. I recorded his web conference for journalists in August. Lester Brown has been tracking the world's grain supplies for decades.
Another thing that I've learned, at least from this experience, is how lucky we have been that this heat wave was in Moscow and not in Chicago or Beijing. I say that because Russia produces at most 100 million tons of wheat. Even if it loses 40% of the harvest, which it's close to doing now, it would be a loss of 40 million tons in the world grain harvest. But if Chicago were to have a July with average temperatures 14 degrees above the norm, the U.S. could lose half of its grain harvest. The U.S. harvests about 400 million tons of grain a year. 300 million of that is corn, most of it grown in the Midwest. Chicago is at the heart of the U.S. Corn Belt. 50% of 400 million tons would be 200 million tons. But even 150 or 100 million tons would be an enormous setback for a world where carryover stocks are right on the edge of what we consider to be secure. Or we could look at Beijing. Beijing is near the heart of the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn. China, like the U.S., produces 400 million tons of grain per year. A heat wave in the North China Plain could easily cut that harvest by 100 million tons, maybe by 150 or more. What I draw from this is that we have to take global warming far more seriously than we are now doing as a society. If this teaches us anything, it is that we need to cut carbon emissions and cut them fast. We need to cut them fast before climate change spirals out of control. Because if we reach that point, then intense heat waves, such as the one that's taken over Moscow, and indeed much of Western Russia over the last 7 weeks, could be occurring more frequently and in more dangerous places in terms of world food security. I've mentioned Chicago and Beijing. I could mention other places. But to anyone who's prepared to think about it, this heat wave centered around Moscow has to be a wake-up call for the world. And we need to do something about climate change and do it quickly.
That was Lester Brown, author of Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. That's a good idea. Find out a lot more at earthpolicy.org. Now we continue with lessons for the future from the grim heat wave and firestorm in Russia during the summer of 2010.
Number 8.
Home gardens, community gardens, and survival gardens died. beyond certain limits, plants cannot cope with the hotter climate and drought. Survivalists should begin testing their varieties and their strategies for cooling plants and watering them, or consider relocating to a microclimate regulated by the ocean or other large bodies of water.
Number 9.
Mobile conditioners sold out within 3 weeks, just as the heat set in. Many Moscow-based companies failed to foresee this heat, and they didn't want to fill their warehouses because of the crisis.
In a situation where no amount of money can buy you a gulp of fresh air, emergency centers are receiving thousands of calls from people suffering from heat stroke and sunburn.
People with lung diseases will find it hard, of course, so it'd be better to take them somewhere where there's no smoke. Another option would be to buy them a respiratory mask. They sell them in pharmacies.
Наталья Нойкова, RT, Moscow.
Fans, air conditioners, and inflatable pools sold out very quickly. Money could not buy a cool place or fresh air. Air conditioners may be useless if the power goes out. Consider your tools.
10.
Some wealthy Russians were able to get out, including government officials. With the poor stuck and dying, class stress or even violence is possible during extreme climate events. Think New Orleans under Hurricane Katrina.
11.
The electric grid is strained and power lines burned down, including those coming from nuclear power stations. Brownouts and blackouts are likely in the future, even in countries like Great Britain or America.
Number 12.
People suffer extreme psychological stress. Will your baby, grandma, or asthmatic husband be okay? Are you afraid to go out for work or supplies? Will crime and violence flare in the day-after-day relentless heat? Do people come to fear the weather? What are the long-term mental health risks?
Of when the fire started, and it was literally just a wall of fire as tall as the trees. It was terrifying, and they said that it all happened in almost a matter of seconds. There was almost literally nothing people could do. The fire spread from the trees to the houses, burning them down in seconds. People losing everything that they've been accumulating for their entire lives. Now they don't know what to do, how to start over again. And this, of course, is just one of the villages in Russia where such a terrible thing has happened all across the country, with the fires ravaging central Russia for over a month. Thousands of people have been left homeless.
13.
Even more carbon was released into the atmosphere. Global warming will feed more global warming. The Russian fires released millions of tons of carbon from the forests into the sky. The black particles swirled up into the international Arctic, darkening snow, hastening more melting. Brown clouds traveled as far as Beijing.
14.
The economic costs continue to mount for Russia. Forest jobs lost, workers don't show up, expensive firefighting and restoration costs, roads wiped out, crops wiped out, including orchards, farm equipment, and buildings. In Russia, the loss is estimated at least 1% of the GDP.
And number 15.
Public anger mounts, and big government often fails to handle anything with competence. Regime change, as we may yet see in Pakistan after the floods, is always possible after major climate hits. The long-term impact on public confidence is unknown. Governments may swing to authoritarian forms or break down into smaller states or even anarchy. The only way to control our path toward the future, to limit the horror of these trends, is to control our carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases. The alternative, as climate progress blogger Joe Rome says, is hell and high water. The top man at the Russian weather forecast agency, called Rosgidromet, one Alexander Frolov, told AFP News, quote, "From the moment of our foundation of our country, we can say, in the last period of 1,000 years, no similar heat wave has been observed neither by ourselves nor by our ancestors," unquote. From Moscow, Associated Press reporter Simon Schuster reported this historic moment, quote, "At a meeting of international sporting officials in Moscow on July 30th, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev announced that in 14 regions of the country, quote, practically everything is burning. The weather is anomalously hot, end quote. Then, as TV cameras zoomed in on the perspiration shining on his forehead, Medvedev announced, quote, "What's happening with the planet's climate right now needs to be a wake-up call to all of us, meaning all heads of state, all heads of social organizations, in order to take a more energetic approach to countering the global changes to the climate," end quote. A former employee of Forest Company International Paper, Medvedev, was instrumental in dismantling the forest monitoring system that could have helped save costs, lives, and the forests. This from globalreport.org.
When the wildfires broke out, stoked by the hottest weather there since record-keeping began more than 130 years ago, officials and the Russian news media reported that firefighters had discovered access roads to the forests were overgrown and in poor repair. Ponds intended to provide water for refilling their tanks were filled with sludge, and their fire trucks were frequently broken down. Local officials also blame a revised 2006 forest code that allowed logging companies to contract out firefighting operations. The new code also cut the number of foresters in the district by half to 150 from 300. As the fire damage mounts, critics have noted that Elim Pulp, a timber company half-owned by International Paper, where President Dmitry Medvedev worked as a corporate lawyer in the 1990s, had lobbied hard for the legislation easing logging regulation. This past week, however, Medvedev said he would hold mayors accountable for negligence.
In 2009, Medvedev announced Russia would increase their warming gases 30% by 2020. Previously, President Medvedev had described global warming as, quote, some kind of tricky campaign made up by some commercial structures to promote their business project, end quote. What else could the head of one of the world's largest fossil fuel exporters say? We can expect the same denial and obstruction from Canada for the same reasons. Ditto Australia. And like Russia, parts of Canada are burning every summer. We can say that the very purpose of our lives now is to help move carbon from deep in the earth into the sky. That's what our economy is about. That is what we do every day, you and I. We buy a product, and that moves all the carbon from extraction of raw resources through production and shipping, on the way to the landfill or incinerator, on the way to its ultimate destination, the atmosphere. Almost everything we want and do is part of this vast system of greenhouse gas production. We are the greenhouse makers. Our children will sweat it out in the world we leave them, unless we find a better way. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for caring enough to listen. This is Power from Above by New England folk singer Dan Berggren.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal. That's our goal. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win. Cause no one owns, no one owns the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. More power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.